Questioning Paul Chapter 4 Part 2.
This is as clear as words allow. If an individual wants to demonstrate that he or she is speaking for God, then that person should share Yahweh's testimony. They should neither annul any aspect of it nor augment God's word with their own ideas. And please, neither personal revelations nor signs and wonders are credible. Yahusha would be even more specific regarding Paul, tailoring the prophetic prediction to reflect the one of the apostles' boast that he met with him in Arabia, the ultimate scriptural wilderness. Listen to God.
Please pay attention, I've told you this beforehand, forewarning you. 24 verse 25, when, therefore, they say to you, behold, he is actually present in the wilderness, you should not go out, yourself, looking in the inner room. You should not think this to be true. Matthew 24 verses 25 to 26.
Making matters even worse for the self-proclaimed apostle, in the next verse, Yahusha will go on to say that when he is next seen on earth, he will be seen by all. It is yet another nail in Shaul's now crumbling coffin. The otherwise ill-fitting instruction of not going out yourself to look in the inner room provides a second insider look into Yahusha's style. The disciples met with him after his fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim in Taman, in a room. It is where they received the treasure of the set-apart spirit. Yahusha had miraculously walked through the wall of the room to appear before them. And while he looked so different than he had previously that they didn't initially recognize him, he did not appear to them as flashing rays light, but instead in the form of a man. The inner room was also the private place Yahusha told his disciples that they should go when they wanted to talk with the Father. Juxtapose this with Paul's claim to have encountered the Messiah on the road to Damascus, and then to meeting with him in Arabia, and once again, Paul is not only a perfect fit for this warning, he is the only candidate who made these claims within the lifetimes of Yahusha's audience. Therefore, the only informed and rational conclusion is that Yahusha specifically warned his disciples about Shaul's deceptive claims and us through them telling us not to believe him. Are you listening? While we are on the topic of Paul hanging himself with his own words, I'd like you to consider his conversion experience, alongside Yahusha's statement regarding Satan. Describing Satan's fall from heaven, and our dominion over him, Luke, in 10 verse 18, translates the Messiah's saying,
"But then he said to them, I saw the adversary, Satan lightning from the heavens, having fallen. Behold, I have given you the authority, ability, and opportunity to trample, being superior to, serpents and scorpions. So upon the entirety of the adversary's power, therefore, you will absolutely never be harmed by his fraudulent deceit." Luke 10 verses 18 to 19.
Now for Paul's depiction of what he experienced.
"But to me it happened, traveling and approaching Damascus around noon, suddenly and unexpectedly from the sky, unearthed by lightning strike, sufficient and adequate light about me." Acts 22 verse 6.
Paul's depiction of the lightning strike, other than to add peri, about or near, to astratvi, lightning, was exactly as Yahusha had described the fall of Satan. Although Shaul did say that the lightning bolt was both unexpected and adequate, whatever that might be worth, it might also be worth noting that Paul's explanation of this lightning strike differs in Acts 9 verse 3, 22 verse 6, and 26 verse 13. No one else was affected by the bolt of lightning in Acts 22 verse 6, but in Acts 26 verse 13, Paul's traveling companions are also enveloped in it.
"In the middle of that day, along the road, King, I saw from the sky, beyond the sun's brightness, shining around me light, and the ones traveling together with me." Acts 26 verse 13.
Beside the fact that all three of Paul's conversion accounts are materially different is that the primary meaning of hyper isn't beyond or to a greater degree, but instead, for the sake of and on behalf of. So in actuality, Paul was saying that he
Sol from the sky for the sake of and on behalf of the sun's brilliance, brightness shining around me.
This is akin to General Constantine, the first pope, seeing a pagan cross in the sky superimposed upon his god, which was the unconquerable sun, and then hearing a voice, perhaps the same one Paul said he heard, saying, in this sign, conquer. But even when we turn to the secondary meaning of hyper, with the shining around, being beyond, the sun's brightness, we find Paul saying something that would not only have permanently blinded everyone, but would have been such a unique event in the human experience, it would have been duly noted and recorded in Damascus. And speaking of Damascus, why would Yahusha reveal himself there, and not in Jerusalem, and as lightning rather than as a man? Paul said things in his own defense that he never should have thought, much less conveyed. Along those lines, Paul's depiction of his encounter with Yahusha, as lightning, as a flash of light from the sky, was inconsistent with the way the risen Messiah appeared to the women at the tomb, to his disciples in the upper room, to the men on the road to Emmaus, and to some 500 other witnesses over the course of 40 days, in which he always appeared as a regular, nondescript man. It was also different from the way Yahweh appeared to Adam, Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and Yaakov/Ezekiel. Yahweh is actually humble.
He has no good looks or majesty. When we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Yahshua 53:2.
Beyond these comparisons, you may have noticed that Yahusha gave his witnesses the express authority to trample upon serpents and scorpions, in the context of confronting Satan's power. We know that the scriptural metaphor for Satan was established as a serpent, in the Torah's presentation of the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. This symbolism was then reinforced 4,000 years later by Yahusha, when he said that religious clerics were the children of poisonous snakes in Matthew 23. But even with pateo, to step and tread underfoot, we find another correlation to the Torah, because there we were told that Satan would bruise man's heel. And while that explains the association between Satan and these serpents, why did Yahusha add scorpions, in the context of his prophetic portrayal of Shaul's spiritual encounter? Those who were paying close attention know the answer. You may recall that Shaul claimed that his enormous ego was held in check because,
therefore it should be self-evident, in order that I not become overly proud and be lifted up, exalting myself beyond what would be justified, there was given to me a sharp goad and troubling scorpion stinger in the body, a messenger and spiritual envoy of Satan, in order to strike and restrain me, controlling me, so that as a result at the present time there is the possibility that I might not be considered, currently exalting myself beyond what would be justified, lifting myself up. 2 Corinthians 12:6-7.
In addition to being a sharp-pointed prod or thorn, scallops means scorpion. In a criminal trial, as in this evaluation, the details tell the tale. And rest assured, there is yet another convicting detail hidden within this confession. While it's a big-picture item, it is also worth noting that in the Olivet Discourse, in the context of warning his disciples about the likes of Paul, Yahusha said that when he returns, he will be seen by everyone from the horizon in the west to the east, and not just by one fellow in the company of a couple of others. If Yahusha was telling the truth, Paul was lying. So could it be? Is it possible that Yahusha was right about Paul? Was his bout with the lightning bolt actually an encounter with Satan? It is interesting to acknowledge, after all, that Paul seemed to know. And to prove this, we are going to take a stroll through Shaul's second letter to the Greeks living next to the Isthmus of Corinth, because our spiritual spokesman has a lot to say about himself, including that he has become insane, and about Satan, who he admits to having possessed and controlled him. After shaking down his followers for money, saying in 2 Corinthians 9:7 that
God loves a cheerful giver,
thereby encouraging them to dig deep if they wanted to be rewarded by his God, Paul tried to undermine Yahweh's most treasured possession, his covenant, saying that he was engaged in the war against the flesh, which is a reference to circumcision, the sign of the covenant. In 2 Corinthians 10 verses 3 to 4, he wrote in 10 verse 5 that
we are destroying speculations and taking every thought captive.
He was in essence removing evidence and reason from the equation so that faith in his message might prevail over knowing God. Paul wanted belief to trump understanding. Then, contradicting his own overt animosity toward legalism, the founder of the Christian religion hypocritically wrote,
and we are ready to punish all disobedience, whenever your obedience is complete. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 6.
Not only is obedience something Yahweh opposes, justice is his, not ours. Paul told his followers in 2 Corinthians 10 verse 7,
not to look outwardly,
so as to avoid observing the Torah, I suppose, but instead
to consider what is within.
All in support of a faith nurtured by feelings and beliefs rather than conviction derived from observation and contemplation. Of his role promoting such rubbish, the always arrogant self-promoter wrote,
even if I should boast somewhat further about our authority, I will not be put to shame. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 8.
I imagine Satan thinking the same thing. This is followed by another odd and indicting comment.
For I do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 9.
Sure, the tone is condescending and the prose bizarre, but unless written by a despot with a large and ruthless army, why would a letter terrify anyone? An even more peculiar reference is conveyed by,
for they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive, and his speech is contemptible. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 10.
While I don't care what Paul looked like, and you'd have to be delusional to view his rhetoric as weighty, he was correct in this regard. His speech was contemptible. But alas, this devolves into an incomprehensible clash of egos in 2 Corinthians 10 verse 11 through 18, with Shaul positioning himself as the only one whose boasts are justified. Paul digresses further in opening of the 11th chapter of his second letter to the Corinthians, writing,
I wish that you would bear with me in a little foolishness, but indeed you are bearing with me. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 1.
Unless I'm reading this wrong, to put up with Paul is to be foolish. But seriously, why would anyone want to suffer such foolishness if he or she could instead observe God's brilliance by reading the Torah? And even though Shaul errantly wrote that
love is not jealous,
in his first letter to those living in Corinth, now he admits to the same audience,
for I am jealous for you. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 2.
Ever the chameleon and schemer, in conjunction with this hypocrisy, Paul wants to present those who have been beguiled by his letters as pure virgins, which is to say untouched by the Torah and its God. This is the conclusion of 2 Corinthians 11 verse 2 as presented from the New American Standard Bible. Paul's next statement is among his most beguiling, because it is predicated upon being a virgin to the Torah by the simplicity of Christ. Also rendered from the NASB, it reads,
but I am afraid, lest as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your minds should be led astray from the simplicity and purity of Christ. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 3.
This is to suggest that if a person ignores everything, and simply believes, that they are pure, and thus free from satanic deception. And yet Yahweh says just the opposite, that the only way to prevent being beguiled is to observe his teaching. While Shaul craftily deployed the exact same tactic Satan used in the garden, that of removing Yahweh's instructions from their context and misquoting him to convey a believable delusion, at issue here is that faith is simple because it isn't based upon anything real. It requires no knowledge or understanding. But without knowledge and understanding, Yahusha is unknowable, and what he did and said cannot be understood. So while Yahweh's desire to build a growing family through his covenant is a relatively simple concept, the means he deployed to facilitate it, so that he could include us within it, is anything but simplistic. There is a reason that Yahweh's teaching and guidance in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms requires over 1,000 pages of precise instructions to accomplish his intended goal. If he intended it for simpletons, he'd have drawn a couple of pictures and not wasted our time or his, but that wouldn't have achieved his goal, because he wants to spend eternity with those who are eager to learn, with those who enjoy the adventure of discovery. Moreover, the directions which systematically reveal who God is and what he is offering, while explaining how we can most beneficially respond to him, are too essential to our relationship and to our salvation to shortchange. Yahusha consistently answered every question, including explaining who he was and what he was doing, by directing his audience's attention to the Torah and prophets. There was no shortcut to understanding then and still isn't now. Furthermore, once a person comes to know Yahusha, they become Torah observant because he was Torah observant. But when this occurs, they cease to be Christians because they come to recognize that Paul's opposition to the Torah puts them in opposition to God, and that is why Shaul wanted to present pure virgins to his one to be God. Until a person appreciates the connection between Yahusha and Yahweh, and between Yahusha and Yahweh's Torah, there is no way to properly respond to and thus benefit from his fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuah, and thus no way to be saved. Such a person cannot process anything Yahusha said during his initial and most comprehensive public declaration known as the Sermon on the Mount. As a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, Yahusha is profoundly revealing, tangibly demonstrating the extraordinary depth and complexity of a God who is neither shallow nor simple. Demonstrating that these conclusions are correct, Shaul was afraid that his simplistic and erroneous presentation of the Messiah would be exposed and criticized by those who knew better, so he wrote,
"For if one comes and preaches another Jesus whom we have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear beautifully." 2 Corinthians 11 verse 4 from the NASB.
The actual Yahusha bears no resemblance to the Christian Jesus, a character who has far more in common with Dionysus and Mithras than Yahweh or his Torah. The Pauline Christian misnomer is no longer the living manifestation of the Word of God, but is instead a caricature contrived to annul it. As for a different spirit, Yahweh has but one spirit that we can receive, the set-apart spirit, and she exists to help us understand and then share Yahweh's Torah. That means Paul's different spirit represents the adversary. Turning to a different gospel, Yahweh has but one evangelion, beneficial messenger and healing message, his Messiah and his Torah. And yet while they are one in the same, they are in wholesale conflict with Paul's preaching. As for bear beautifully, I'll let you grapple with that one, because following bear foolishly, it doesn't make much sense to me. This leads to another arrogant and indeed errant announcement.
"For I consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostles." 2 Corinthians 11 verse 5.
Paul's pride became blinding. Incapable of being rational, he considered himself brilliant.
"But even if I am unskilled in speech, yet I am not so in knowledge. In fact, in every way we have made evident to you in all things." 2 Corinthians 11 verse 6.
By comparison to Yahweh and thus Yahusha, I'm dumb as a stone. By comparison to Moses and Daud, I'm but a flickering candle in relation to a bonfire. But at least I know that the only source of knowledge worth considering is Yahweh's testimony. If Paul was a fraction as smart as he claimed to be, he would have educated his audience by drawing their attention to the terms and conditions of the covenant. He would have explained how the covenant's benefits were enabled by Yahusha's work during the Micrae. But instead, he condemned the covenant, created a new one, and denounced the invitations to meet with God because they got in the way of his faith. If it was not so sad, the notion that Paul questioned
whether I committed a sin in humbling myself, because I preached the gospel of God to you without charge. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 7.
Would be funny. Can you imagine being so full of yourself that you'd think, or worse, right, that you might be committing a sin by being humble, or that you ought to have charged for sharing the stream of verbal diarrhea that he has spewed our way? And while it should be obvious, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind you that Yahweh is a Torah, not a gospel. If you think that I'm being too hard on this arrogant, errant, and delusional one of the apostle, since he has suggested that he shortchanged himself for not billing the Corinthians for this beguiling message, you might want to consider.
I robbed other churches, taking wages to sever you, 2 Corinthians 11 verse 8.
It is interesting that Shaul tells us that.
For when the brethren came from Macedonia, they supplied my need. 11 verse 9.
The Torahless one known as the Antichrist will come from Macedonia. Recognizing that Paul never quoted Yahweh or Yahusha, at least not accurately, he lied when he wrote,
as the truth of Christ is in me.
But not when he concluded,
this boasting of mine will not be stopped in the regions of Achaia, 2 Corinthians 11 verse 10.
Followed by,
why? Because I do not love you. God knows. 11 verse 11.
Shaul not only knew, but acknowledged, that he was competing with others whose claims were more credible, the disciples, and that his message was considerably different than theirs.
But what I am doing, I will continue to do, that I may cut off opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the matter about which they are boasting. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 12.
While Yahusha's disciples did not boast, an insecure individual like Paul views any confident individual as an affront to his credibility. A systematic review of the literature emanating out of the mid to late first century reveals that the only prophets and apostles which Paul could have viewed as being in competition with him, and whose message was opposed to his, were Yahusha's disciples and perhaps those who had learned from them, and thus those filled and equipped by the Spirit on Shavuot. That makes this next statement especially toxic.
For such are false prophets, treacherous and deceitful workmen masquerading as Messiah's apostles, 2 Corinthians 11 verse 13.
At the time Paul wrote this letter to the Corinth assembly, he alone was a false prophet, treacherous and deceitful, masquerading as the Messiah's apostle. And history tells us that no one outside of Paul and his followers claimed apostleship to the Corinthians. Moreover, since there is no evidence that Paul ever issued an accurate prophecy, there is no reason to view this as a prediction of future events either. Paul's lists of future human attributes in Romans and elsewhere were already common to his day, especially in Rome. And since it has not yet occurred, Paul's prediction that the rapture would take place during his lifetime wasn't true. Most every English translation ignores the inclusion of autos, himself, in this next statement, because of what it implies. And of course, they aren't keen on providing a complete translation of Thauma, because this sounds like a confession. Literally, in the order Paul wrote the words, the next sentence reads,
and no wonder, himself a great object of worship. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 14.
But before we conclude that Satan was being called great, and a wonderful object of worship, a word of caution is in order. There is no direct Greek equivalent to the English word do, with regard to do not, so it could be, and probably should be, supplied. This reshapes the text to read,
and do not marvel.
Also, while autos, translated himself, follows the noun thauma, wonder, in the Greek text, and precedes the conjunction gar, for, which begins the next thought or sentence, depending upon the punctuation, it is common for conjunctions to follow pronouns if the thoughts are being combined, as opposed to being isolated in separate sentences. But adding to the potential confusion, Paul routinely omits pronouns in his letters, so the specific inclusion of autos after thauma would normally convey himself a marvel. Moreover, there is no denying that Paul was taken in by Satan's glorious manifestation and radiant brilliance, in 2 Thessalonians, a passage we'll review in a moment. Yet since there is a way to avoid the problem of praising Satan here in 2 Corinthians, by adding do, in front of not, and then repositioning the pronoun, I'm compelled to join the first and second halves of the 14th verse into a single sentence. Combined, they would then read,
"And do not wonder, for indeed, he, the adversary Satan, changes his appearance into a spiritual, heavenly messenger of light." 2 Corinthians 11 verse 14.
And while that solves one problem, it creates another. This is exactly like Paul experienced him. And as always, Paul's inadequate writing style remains especially prone to misinterpretation, leaving us wondering what he actually meant to say. Further, Satan's origin and name, Amalek, spiritual messenger, named Halal ben Shakar, tells us that he is a spiritual, heavenly messenger radiating light, so this is hardly news. Paul's next line is as clear as it is telling. It is designed to deflect attention away from him being judged a false prophet. So Paul says that, rather than evaluate him objectively based upon his words, comparing them to God's, he wants to be evaluated subjectively based upon his motivation.
"It is not surprising therefore when also his servants masquerade as ministers of righteousness, of which the end result and motivation will be according to their works." 2 Corinthians 11 verse 15.
But yet judging someone's motivation, their intent, is pure speculation. So Paul would have us move from facts and reason to opinions. That doesn't sound godly to me. Illuminating this problem, telos, rendered end result and motivation, is based upon telo, and that's telling because it describes someone who sets out to achieve a particular goal. It infers that the ultimate evaluation of these people should focus on their motivations, as opposed to the content of their messages, and it should take place at the end of time, as opposed to when the message is being delivered. Further, Paul's evaluation is also predicated upon a person's deeds, rather than what they have to say. As such, Paul's means to determine whether a person is a false prophet bears no resemblance whatsoever to Yahweh's tests. Of this, we should not be surprised. But this is Paul's message, Paul's test, and Paul's defense on behalf of his spirit. It also reflects Paul's less than divine grammatical style.
"Furthermore I say, not someone I presume I am ignorant and irrational, but if not really and as foolishness, by you will receive in order that and how little someone who I boast." 2 Corinthians 11 verse 16.
Since this appears to be gibberish, let's consider what the scholastic sources reveal. The Nestle-Aland MCREYNOLDS interlinear reads,
"Again I say not some me might think and thinking to be if but not indeed if also as unthinking welcome me that also I little some might brag."
That wasn't an improvement. Moving on to the English Standard Version interlinear, we find that it departs significantly from the text, ignoring and adding many words.
"I repeat, let no one think me being omitted, foolish. But even if you do, added, not also, omitted, accept me as a, added, fool, so that, added, I too may, added, boast a little."
The New International Version interlinear suggests,
"Again I say not anyone me think foolish to be if, omitted, otherwise not really, omitted, even if as foolish receive you me, in, added, order that, added, I also a, added, little bit, added, someone, omitted, may boast."
Moving from the most trusted interlinears to the supposedly literal New American Standard Bible, we find,
"Again I say, let no one think me foolish, but if you do, receive me even as foolish, that I also may boast a little."
All we can say for sure is that the writing and message quality are well beneath God's capability. And yet, I'm compelled to offer something sensible. So, here is my best guess regarding Paul's testimony.
"Furthermore, I say, let no one presume I am foolish. But even if not, and I am like the foolish, you will receive and accept me in order that I may boast a little.
No matter the interpretation, this statement is actually worse in content and style than anything we have encountered in Galatians. And once again, we can't blame this on scribal error. The words are the same in Papyrus 46, from the late 1st century, as they are in the Nessalaland. The incomprehensible, even arrogant, nature of the text is Paul's fault. Of course, if you are a Christian and believe that this verbal diarrhea was the inspired word of God, then your God is an incompute, which is probably worse.
What I say is not according to the Lord/Master's way of speaking, but to the contrary, as in foolishness in this substance and nature of boasting. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 17.
If this is correct, Paul is admitting the obvious. He was not speaking for Yahweh or Yahusha, but was instead speaking foolishly by bragging on his own behalf or worse. And I say or worse, because this follows an explanation of how Satan influences false prophets. Not to belabor the point, but the Nessalaland interlinear isn't any clearer.
What I say not by master, I say but as in thoughtlessness in this substance of the brag.
The NASB supports my conclusion.
That which I am not speaking as the Lord would, but in foolishness, in this confidence of boasting.
Try as they would to shade the meanings to protect Paul's credibility, this remains extremely incriminating, even damning. And Paul wasn't finished exposing himself.
Because many may boast according to the flesh, I also glorify myself and brag. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 18.
His personality and Satan's are beginning to morph, becoming indistinguishable. But even if you aren't yet comfortable with this assessment, surely you recognize that the man who wrote these words was not inspired by God. Paul's testimony has become so self-centered, so braggadocios, so irrelevant, so unlike Yahweh and his prophets. Let's continue to seek verification of these words from other translations. In that regard, the NASB wrote,
since many boast according to the flesh, I will boast also.
For indeed, gladly you accept the senseless and foolish being wise. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 19.
This was hardly the place for sarcasm, and yet that is what we find. I'm beginning to think that Paul has either become psychotic, and thus has lost touch with reality, or that his disdain for his audience has caused him to taunt them by pulling back the veil hiding his hideous nature. It is as if Paul's arrogance, his sense of superiority, has led him to believe that his audience was so stupid, they'd never figure him out, much less hold him accountable. However, that is not how things materialized. Based upon what Shaul wrote Timothy in his final letter, most everyone abandoned him.
You know this, that all of those in Asia have turned away from me, 2 Timothy 1 verse 15.
But alas, with Martian as his future publicist and promoter, those who did not know him nearly as well would become fooled, millions of them. They are known as Christians, today. According to the NASB, Paul wrote,
for you, being so wise, bear with the foolish gladly.
While this is no better, to achieve this translation, they had to append Paul's arrangement of words. This onslaught of foolishness begs the question, are we witnessing psychosis in Paul, from the Greek psyche, mind and soul and osis, deranged and abnormal? Most every aspect of his behavior, his attitude, and his testimony fit the textbook definition of psychotic. His letters increasingly suggest that he has lost contact with reality. He has suffered hallucinations that he calls revelations, and his claims are often delusional. He has been violent and his judgment is seriously impaired. In the immediate aftermath of his interlude with Satan on the way to Damascus, he was nearly catatonic.
End of part 2.